Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
Ah, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Ah, good to be seen.
Yes.
We're here in person again. Lovely, lovely.
We are. Oh, my God.
It's a mix, dear listeners. You know, we got to make it work however we can make it work, because we want to bring you this content, and we can't always be together. So it's special.
Yeah. Because we got together. Fucking lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got lives.
Well, I have a life.
I mean, you have an afterlife.
yes.
I have an actual life. Unlike you, I will not A, live forever, and B, you know,
aren't willing to do what it takes to live forever.
Exactly. I'm not willing to do what it takes.
We'll just leave that out there. They don't need to know. They don't need to know all the details. Oh my gosh. Well, I'm excited because we have a winner of Drag Race. So this will be old news to you, dear listener, if you're a Drag Race
fan. Spoiler alert.
Right. Although I mean, it was like out before the episode even aired, you know, how the world is. But yeah, I mean, I'm very happy. Again, it was exactly who I thought would win. I thought it was unfair that she was there to begin with.
You thought that it was exactly who was going to win?
Yeah, I said from the get-go, I was like, Jinx is going to win this.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, I agree with you that, like, Jinx should have rightfully won it. But I don't think it was not clear-cut because of the other people.
I felt it was very Ben de la Creme, you know, for All-Stars 2 or 3 or 4 or 5?
3 or
7? No, this was 7.
3.
I don't remember, but it was just like Benda, this was crushing everything. And even though Jinx wasn't winning everything, I still think she like just was doing such a great job the whole time that I'm like, I really thought that she was going to win. I thought it was unfair that she was there. I didn't think she needed to even be there at all. Like, I think she's proven herself. Again, not to say that other people, they're like, I mean, there was some stiff competition, obviously.
Yeah.
But I've been Team Jinx since 2013 or whatever it was.
Amen.
I remember when she walked in the room, I was like, if she doesn't win, I'm going to be mad.
Amen and hallelujah.
Yeah. So I was very happy that she won. So yeah, I was Team Jinx. ##Browns Team Jinx with a K, because she's paid extra for it.
Exactly. I woke up. I woke up on Saturday, the Saturday after we watched the finale together.
We did.
With our paramours. Nice. Mm-hmm. And, I woke up the next day and I was like, Beyonce has a new album that's inspired by disco and queerness and house music. And Jinx Monsoon is the queen of all queens. The world is like arcing toward justice.
I like that you brought up Beyonce. We're not going to talk about it here because if you're subscribed to our Patreon, we're going to have a video. So I do have to, first of all, apologize, Patreon members. We sent out our newsletter and told you what films we were going to do, and we changed our mind about one. So
because we can do it.
Yes. So we have a different film that's going to be up either this week that you're listening to, maybe next week. Yeah. We'll see. But we do a whole conversation about the Beyonce record, so you can hear all of our thoughts on Renaissance over there on Patreon.
You didn't know it, but you were agreeing to be cucked just then. We cucked you.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot. Anyway, so back to the dregs of it all. Again, I mean, I think everybody's a winner. I'm very, like, I actually really appreciated RuPaul's, like, statement of, like, you know, the viewers are the winners, because, like, it was really fun to, like, just watch, you know. I mean, I think it's pushing it a little bit to call it the greatest drag show on earth. There are lots of incredible drag, you know, performances happening every week that aren't on national television. Plenty of amazing performers that will never be showcased by Drag Race or Dragula or whatever comes next. You know, but in something that's mainstream on television, it was just super fun to watch, like, a lot of people at the top of their game be great, have fun, stay the whole time, you know, get to show their looks, get to work their beauty, you know, out in these streets.
Yes.
You know, in really, you know, cool, supportive ways. So, yeah, I definitely think we were the winners. It's been kind of funny because I've seen, like, on Reddit and on, like, Twitter, people saying, like, this should be how like Drag Race is. Like, because some of these, you know, people that come on still are not like, they're not wealthy, but they spend a lot of money on looks that they never get to, yeah, to show on television. And furthermore, they never get to show anywhere ever because you sign contracts that they like get to keep your stuff or like they own like a lot of the looks. So people don't always get to use what they invested in ever. Or they have to like use it on something related to the show at some point in the future. So that all, you can read about all that drama. I think there was like a Vice article or something breaking down the cost of Drag Race.
I think it was the Vice or them, but yeah, they talked about how it's like tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, and Cornbread, it posted like, I spent, you know, tons of money on outfits that I can't wear anywhere. Like, so it's not even just about showcasing on television. I can't wear them at all. So I do like that idea, but it was kind of funny. There were several of the famous, you know, the 120 drag queens that have been through RuPaul's Drag Race or whatever it is now, 150. I don't even know.
The Drag Race Cinematic Universe.
Yes, 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 yes. What would that be? DRCU? Drag Race Cinematic Universe?
Well, it would
universe?
Be like RuPaul's Drag Race.
Oh, yeah. RPDRCU. LMNOPQR. Code. Hashtag Drag Race. that were like, no, I need tears and cut up wigs. And no, I want to see the drama. I want, you know. So some people did not vibe with this. I'm not conflict avoidant, but I don't like to encourage competition or conflict either. Like, I don't find it fun to be catty or to be nasty for mean reasons or to be competitive. So I actually really enjoyed this season and I would like to see more things done that way.
Yes. In the most recent, as of releasing this episode, it'll be the previous week's episode of the podcast Las Culturistas, which I've talked about a lot. They had Trixie Mattel on again. Oh. You actually would really like this episode.
I should listen. Yeah,
you should listen.
I love to listen to Trixie talk.
They talked to Trixie about Drag Race and about All Star specifically, and Trixie's insight is very, very good, and I'm assuming, like, if I had to bet money, I would be like, it's almost entire, it's probably exactly what like the Drag Race production staff was going through when they were producing this season. Cause she talks about how, like, you know, you can't, like, let's put, like, you can't have negative feedback on an all winner season, cause then it's like gonna devalue, like, oh, maybe they shouldn't have won their season.
Right.
And then they're the one, like, because they elevated them and they brought them back. So it's like they're creating this problem for themselves.
Yeah, I've read that in other places. I don't exactly agree because, like, there are people that are superstars that fumble and we don't, well, actually, I guess maybe we do to some degree because we like to tear down our idols. It's one of our favorite things to do, especially successful.
Unless you're in the Confederacy.
Women.
They don't like tearing anything down.
Well, that's true. Very, very true. But we're not talking about those Nazis. Not today, at least. Well, maybe later. but no, anyways.
We already did that, like, in the recent episode. We talked about Nazis.
Right. So we can, like, I think some of them legitimately wore things that should have been, can be critiqued. I don't think the idea that there wasn't anything negative said would, like, really hurt them. I mean, yeah, if they were up there, like, you're trash, your drag is trash. I mean, it's stuff they used to do in the old days where they did really tear apart, like, yeah, queens and really put down particular types of drag. But I think they could have critiqued some of the hemlines or some of the color choices or, you know, like, some of, like, stuff that's, like, rather benign, mm-hmm, you know, and it wouldn't have, like, ruined the queen's legacy. But it was a choice they made. And, again, I didn't mind the positivity. You know, I'm not really saying that I wanted to see, you know,
it
them tear each
other apart. It wasn't also, like, toxically positive.
Right.
It wasn't just like, you're perfect, you're beautiful, you look like Linda Evangelista. No, it was it was always within the context and, like, even, like, because, you know, Jinx doesn't sew. Like, Queen of Queens doesn't sew. Like, that's a huge, to me, that's a huge deal.
Yeah.
Like, what it says that is that your personality will win through, your look will carry that forward, but, like, it's your personality and your ability to perform. And whether or not you can sew is, like, you know, inconsequential as long as you know how to, like, hot glue some stuff together or are willing to build coalition with other people and, you know, and that's part of it.
Yeah, but even that comes with success, you know, again, like if, you know, because some drag queens do spend hours and hours and hours building and designing and stitching and sewing, you know, and they've chosen to make that their thing. But that takes a lot of time. And if you want to tour, if you want to like be on Broadway, if you like you, there are other things you have to do, you know, like I would love, fucking love to have the luxury of never changing another guitar string for as long as I live.
Oh,
you know what I mean? Like, so, like, I would love to forget how to do it, you know, just because somebody else does it for me. Like, I always...
You want
to
be the RuPaul of guitars.
Right, when I was playing, and you know, in like, in the band and stuff, it's like, that's how I felt, like, that's success, is somebody else taking care of my fucking guitars.
Because of time, like, you know, that's...
Yeah,
because
it's a lot of time. Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of time involved in doing it, you know, especially, like, mine that are, you know, fucking... you know, 12 strings. So there are days I'm changing 36, 48 fucking strings on a guitar to prepare for shows. You know, so again, like, yeah, if I was a famous drag queen and I had the money, yeah, one, I'm going to support other artists who are good at it, you know, so I'm going to build a community of people that, you know, she's worked with the same people even before she was famous.
Yeah.
You know, she has always supported the community she came from, you know, so I'm like, I love that.
I also completely, like, I was watching a clip of something with Bob.
Oh, yeah.
And I completely forgot or just didn't know that Bob and Jinx have the same drag mother, Peaches Christ.
Yeah.
Like, I freaking love that. And it totally makes sense. It absolutely 100% makes sense for Jinx, for sure. Just how, like, irreverent, but, like, also political, like, especially for Bob, like, how politically active.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I was very happy Jinx won. Again, there's lots of kerfuffle online. There always will be about, you know, I mean, and I'm like, to be honest, I did sort of agree with some of the lip syncs. I'm like, well, I do think that lip sync was better than the other one, but whatever. I don't, you know, I'm not RuPaul making the decision. Mm-hmm. So I was very happy to see Jinx win just because, you know, I was just so happy for her to get validated in her first season, and she's gotten to go on and do so many cool things. So, like, you know, I'm happy for her.
The Queen of Queens is, I believe she identifies this way. The Queen of Queens is also trans.
Right. Yeah.
Trans and non-binary.
Yeah. Yeah, so I love it. I love the whole thing.
True neutral.
There we go. On the flip side of things, you have watched the first two episodes of American Horror Stories, which we're watching right now. It's kind of weird because I have a Wednesday watch group because of American Horror Story, but American Horror Stories comes out on Thursdays, the day after we meet. So we're one episode behind that just came out. So we watched... what was the Dollhouse and Aura?
Yes, Aura. Yeah.
So Dollhouse was super fun, and you know, we're talking about again. You know, spoiler alert. Sorry, folks. You know, but the twist in it is that it turns out to be an origin story for a coven character, Spalding. Mm-hmm. But what was really funny is when the episodes are playing. You know, we're all together, and some of us had seen Coven, and some hadn't. You know, had not been that early as part of the American Horror Story watch party that we used to host. And they show
Dennis O'Hare.
Dennis O'Hare's character, like, obsessed with dolls, and then he mentions, like, his henchman's tongue is missing. And I'm like, oh, how cool. Like, you know, they're, like connecting. Because, like, in Coven, like, Spalding was obsessed with baby dolls, and he didn't have a tongue because he cut it out. And I was like, I like these little, you know, again, because I... was one of the people that I really dug the, like, either Dante's Inferno or, like, they're trapped in some kind, like, these are, because some of the people repeat, and, like, you have Lily Rabe's character who says the line, like, you know, something isn't right here, like, in several of the seasons. It just gives you echoes that maybe they're the same souls trapped, you know? So I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. They're, like, echoing Spalding a little bit and, you know, kind of hinting at that. So then when it turned out that the son was Spalding, I was like, ah, I see. It was also fun to see baby Myrtle, although they gave her, like, old Myrtle's hair, which was a little weird because that's not how she looked as a little girl. Because they showed her in Coven with, like, her hair was a little
it was softer. Like, I was like, oh, the continuity is off. Like, someone, Ryan Murphy's cashing a check and the continuity is off.
Yeah, and also Spalding was older than Myrtle. Not by a lot, but I think he was, like, in his 20s when she was, like, a young, like, a teenager. Like, you know. So they were kind of playing with that. But I enjoyed the fan service. That's fine. I didn't want to, you know, dig into it too deeply.
100% fan service. So, like, the dolls of it all, I didn't, like, Dennis O'Hara and dolls, I'm like, okay, like, I didn't really go to Spalding for that. But then when Kobe was like, you know, I can do a trick, and she, you know, could move things with her mind. I was like, oh, interesting. Maybe it's going to be a witch thing. And then it wasn't until, and he goes so fast that you could miss it, but it's during one of the challenges or the contests where he's basically having them, like, set a formal luncheon service.
Yeah.
And he says, like, you know, how they serve this in the quarter. And he mentions that, you know, the French quarter. And I'm like, oh, and Natchez, Mississippi, proximity to New Orleans. I was like, huh, I wonder if we're going to get a Robichaux moment.
Yeah, yeah. There's something too about the terrapin soup, which is like a type of turtle, you know, like the... yeah, there was something about that too that I was like, wait, what?
Well, also because, like, Myrtle, you know, obsessed with soups and, you know.
Mulligatawny soup.
Italy transport us to Rajasthan.
Magnifica. Yeah, crazy.
Delphine. Balenciaga.
Yeah, so I did enjoy that little bit of fan service. It did feel very like, this is so nonsensical. Like,
yeah, it's also like, I'm gonna run this place, and he's all like, I'm gonna die here. Like, I really wanted him to say, I'm gonna die here.
Yeah, yeah. But I enjoyed that. And then Aura brought back Gabri Sidibe, which was very cool.
Yeah,
I was very happy to see her. And I like, the story was kind of creepy. We were like, oh, this is interesting, and kind of. I agree with you because you had said that it reminded you of.
It's very Dark Mirror or Black Mirror.
Yeah,
Dark Mirror. Dark Cauldron, Black Cauldron, Dark Hair, Black Mirror.
Chaka Khan.
Yes. yes, it reminded me a lot of Black Mirror. I'm not editing that out. I'm keeping that in.
Keep it in, girl. Do it.
And I was like, oh, and look, it has one of the many people in Ryan Murphy's stable, Max Greenfield, showing up, you know, giving us some interracial love, you know, interracial, multi-size thing. I was like, ooh, I love this. Love this whole thing. I really like Max Greenfield. He's really cute.
Well, hey, I'm happy for you then. I want you to always be aesthetically pleased with the actors that appear on your Black Mirrors.
Was that a read?
I don't, you know.
Or is it just a fact?
Look it up. Don't bring any hydrangeas in here. Alrighty. Yeah. So awesome. I'm glad that you're watching that and that you were caught up and we could talk about it, because I was curious about your thoughts, especially with the coven of it all. Yeah, we're enjoying it. It's fun to get together. We're also watching Our Flag Means Death. So we kind of have a scary thing. And then, I mean, I don't really think they're very scary, but we do have people that attend that get freaked out, you know. So we watch Our Flag Means Death after that. And it's, you know, pirate, what we do in the shadows. I'm enjoying it. Silly, you know. I don't know if you watched it, but I bet you'd enjoy it. It's very queer.
I know I would, because, I mean, I love Rhys Darby. I like Taika Waititi. And,
yeah.
You know, I think I would, but, you know, we were just talking about this. Like, who has the time?
Yeah, there's so much to get caught up on, so much to watch, so.
Things that, like, we need to do a list of things when we do our recap of the year. We'll go over the things that we just wanted to have time for, but just for whatever reason did not.
Yeah, there's always so much. So, all right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And then I'm very excited because we are kicking off our Giant Monster Month with the classic 1933's King Kong. Be right back.
Meanwhile, in New Jersey.
So, Marissa, what talking points do you want to hit on in this week's episode?
Well, Jackie, let's talk about how the film addresses the patriarchy. Ooh, and representation of marginalized people. Ooh, ooh, and even philosophical ramifications of good versus evil in horror.
We can point out the triangle boobs, talk about the blood splatter, and, the practical effects. and also the male gaze?
My gaze at the males.
Hi-oh! From feminism to fangirling, the Jersey Ghouls cover all the bases of horror from a woman's perspective.
New episodes are uploaded every other Sunday.
Just search Jersey Ghouls to find us on social media and your favorite podcasting app.
All right, welcome back. So, yes, this month, it's all about sacred beasts of the apocalypse. You know, giant monsters bringing about destruction. So we're going to start with a classic 1933 film, King Kong. So much fun. We're going back. We haven't, well, we did do Creature from the Black Lagoon recently, which was black and white from the 50s. But we haven't done a 30s film in a bit.
I think the last...
Was Bride?
No, well, I'm from the 30s, I don't remember, actually.
Okay, because we've done Dracula, did Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein.
When was, this is probably way older, but like, when was Gollum? De Gollum.
Was that in the 30s, or was that in 1912?
I think it was in the 20s?
Maybe, I can't remember.
Wasn't it like 100 years old?
Yeah, I think we were celebrating
100 years. Done a lot of shows. We've done a lot of episodes, okay.
But, yeah, well, the point is, we haven't been to the 30s. I can't remember when the last time. So
we may be in our 30s, but we have never been to the 30s.
Yes. So, yeah, super fun to visit this. I hadn't watched King Kong in a really long time. I have seen this several times, so I was excited to revisit it. We got... it's directed by Marion C. Cooper and Ernest B. Skedsack? Shodsack?
Oh my God. I thought you were going to say Chodsack.
Oedsack. very cool because James Creelman is the writer, but then Ruth Rose came in and wrote. Did a rewrite. So Ruth Rose is the screenwriter. I'm reading. This is from The Science of Women in Horror, the special effects, stunts, and true stories behind your favorite fright films. And this is by Meg Hofdahl and Kelly Florence. I picked this up at the Renegade Film Festival. They had a cool table of books. So.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, shout out to them. I bought several of their books. So Ruth Rose is the screenwriter who made King Kong into the fast-paced, thrilling adventure it was. She created a monster who was sympathetic and characters who allowed the audience to access their empathy for them. James Ashmore Creelman, who, like I said, is also credited with the screenplay, it was much slower vision of King Kong. And so Rose came in and gave it a rewrite. So again, we have a... Oh, she wrote the end line. Oh, no, it wasn't the airplanes. It was Beauty Killed the Beast. She wrote that.
Good for her.
Yeah. So, again, we have another, as have been kind of the theme lately of a lot of the conversations I've been having, is women's, like, hidden history on really famous films. So, like, Millicent Patrick in Creature from the Black Lagoon being the most recent conversation. So, starring, we got, whatever happened to Faye Ray?
Oh, no. I was going to... I was going to ask you that later. Yeah. I was like, but Joshua, whatever happened to Faye Ray?
I ruined it.
You did. But it's okay. Whatever. No, but like, let's ask it. Whatever happened to Faye Ray?
She died in 2004. She's one of the early Scream Queens.
Is she the earliest Scream Queen?
No, I mean, I'm pretty sure we could say there were others maybe before her. Well, you know, I don't know. You know, but she is probably best remembered as being Anne Darrow in this. So I'm not exactly sure what all she did with her life. But good for her. She died in her sleep of natural causes, which I think is like the best way to go.
Yes.
You know, if you're going to, you know, die. if you have to die, going in your sleep is probably not a bad way to go. And she did a lot of films. Oh my gosh. Wow. This goes on for pages. So good for her. Anyway, so Faye Ray is in this. Robert Armstrong, Bruce Cabot, you know, litany of other folks. And if you don't know, it's about it's kind of cool because it's a film about film. You know, it's about the making of a movie. This director, like documentarian, takes a film crew out into the jungle to ostensibly like make a film. But he's really trying to find out what Kong is and, you know, sort of what happens. And it's a giant ape. And things happen, as do in films. Mm-hmm. Joe, what are your thoughts on La Kong? On Lorena Conga. Really? That is... It's so fun.
I didn't watch it all in one sitting either.
Really? You had to break it up?
Yeah, it was long.
It's 100 minutes.
No, it's, well, yes. It's
104 minutes with Overture. That's an hour and 40 minutes.
No. Sorry, I couldn't do it.
You couldn't do it.
I made it through because, you know, I do the homework, okay? Right. But no, it was like, I was not, let me be full transparent. Everything up until they get to Skull Island was a bore. Absolute, like, you know, I hate this, like, mid-Atlantic, blah, 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 a whiteness. We're going to go conquer this. The black man. Look at this racist Asian that we have here. And then racist portrayal of an Asian, not an Asian person who is racist. And then when, like, actual Kong comes up and I'm like, okay, this is good.
That's true. Imagine that the first screenplay was a hell of a lot slower, you know? So we're very lucky that Miss Rose came in and she did. She already did her magics.
Yes, she did. She
made it faster paced.
She Carrie Fishered it. She script doctored it. Came up.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just not feeling it. It was like really. That's actually when I like paused it because I was watching it. I watched it last night. I started it last night, and I was just like, I can't get through this. It's too late also for me to like listen to this like tough mid-Atlantic dialogue, and then like. Just, you know, I mean, again, it's a sign of the times, and I can't really say anything because that's just how films were done, but, like, just the bumbling, like crowd of it all, like, you know, the clown car of this, like, ship, it's like, you know, everyone, all hands on deck, and they're, like, coming from, I'm like, how many people work on this ship? Is it that big that can fit all this crew? It was just, it gave a lot of, like, it gave, like, Dergolem, right? It gave, like, right. You know how you build the, you see the crowd and, like, that huge theater and stuff? Like, I don't know. I just, it wasn't, the first half of the film really, like, lost me, really was snooze fest, and that kind of tainted the rest of the time. I made it through, it was fine, you know, but it was not my favorite, and I'll take all your hate. People, because actually the whole time, because I haven't seen the remakes of it, but the whole time, but I know, like, you know, the actors and stuff, and I was just like, okay, is this guy the Jack Black, or is this guy the Adrian Brody? Which one's the Sienna Miller? Right, she plays the and Daryl.
Like, I think so. Yeah.
Which one are you? Like,
yeah. Well, first of all, I will say that I like King Kong. Because of, like, again, the cultural conversation around it. It's not necessarily that I like the film itself. I've seen it several times when I was younger and didn't really have a cultural context. And then when Horror Noir was published, and then when they made the documentary and they kind of really dove into, like, Kong and, like, having these, like, conversations, it just became something like, wow, this is pretty amazing. And again, another thing that really helps underline the thesis of our show, which will be in this and then in next week's episode on Godzilla and, you know, and moving forward about, like, you know, the immediate way horror responds and encapsulates, like, you know, cultural anxieties and beliefs about a time. You really see it in King Kong, and you really see it in, you know, so much of what we do. So it's just another one that I think really we can really point to and say that is what this is about.
And you know. I agree with you in that regard. So, like, I'm hoping that after this conversation, after your, you know, your subsequent disquisition on King Kong or illumination for me, I probably will like it better. But you also, you know me, Joshua. I also am very much of the camp where, like, can I be entertained by it solely as a media product that is there to entertain people. And the intention, I believe, for this film is that it's just there to entertain us and not necessarily to, like, because of how it was made and all of that, when we contextualize it, it teaches us about the time, it teaches us about all those things. But when it's made and it's a product of its time, when it's in a contemporary setting, it's just a piece of entertainment. And so that's where I approach a lot of it. And the sweet spot for me and what gets on my, like, yes, Joe will rewatch it list is, like, are you both entertaining as a media artifact, as a production, as an artifact of entertainment and Hollywood and all of that? And can you also speak directly of the time? And so, you know, I want that for every film that we watch. But for this one, it's just like, you need to do, it's going to be one of those, like, we're going to have to do so much. I'm going to have to, like, you know, I'll say, oh, King Kong, and, you know, so much homework. Also, too, it, like, not for nothing, but it did make me want to go back, and I need to do it later. It made me want to rewatch the game that they're playing in Inglourious Basterds, where, like, the major is, like, you know, he's trying to guess who he has, and it's King Kong. And, like, that was one of the first times I was like, huh, interesting. And then interesting where it's like the parallels they're making to, like, blackness, black culture. And then further reinforced and revisited when we watched Horror Noir.
Right. Yeah. Well, I love exactly what you're saying, because I do agree. I also like something that can be entertaining and also spark a conversation. I do, yeah. when I look at King Kong, it's another one of those movies like, man, this must have been so interesting to see as, like, an audience at that time, you know, to go into a theater and, you know, I mean, special effects, like, it's pretty cool. Like, I mean, for that time, I think, like, the miniatures of it all and the, they have a mix. They use some special effects that are, you know, little doll, you know, like, little miniatures, and then something they'd made, like, a giant head of Kong that they could use, and a, you know, a giant hand that they use in the, when he's reaching for the man, you know, in the cave.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm just like, man, this must have been pretty amazing to see in the original, you know, when it was first released. I was trying to find if I could see if there was an original. It apparently holds a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. Again, that could just be because of, like, the nostalgia factor. But anyway, so to kind of start discussing and taking this apart, we have to go back a little bit, because you cannot really talk about King Kong without talking about Ngagi, which is in, they talk about this in Horror Noir. So this was a pre-Hays Code film that was positioned as being a documentary about a tribe of, like, gorilla worshiping women, you know, African women, who were, like, sex slaves to gorillas. And so it's this whole, like, you know, exploitation kind of film, about, like, yeah, you know, this is, it's part of, like, scientific racism, you know, specifically this time, that, like, this is how we prove that that black people, African descended people
are inferior.
Like, they can breed with, you know, gorillas and other animals. And, you know, so this film gets made, gets out there. It's actually a mixture of, like, stolen footage from actual documentaries that I think a woman actually produced. Grace McKenzie's Heart of Africa from 1915. So they stole and used some of her footage. They doctor up some animals in it to make things seem more fantastic, you know, on this, like, you know, hidden island. I think it shows, or they, like, purport that these, you know, this tribe, like, has, like, crossbred with gorillas. So this whole thing comes out. It's this, you know, horrible documentary, you know, horrible film purporting to be a documentary that, again, is informing people who watch it, you know, of these beliefs.
Yeah.
But the important thing is that it was successful. It made, like, $4 million, and RKO immediately greenlit King Kong. Which is,
without Ngagi, you get no King Kong.
Basically, yeah. They, you know, it definitely helped RKO invest in making King Kong. So that's kind of the conditions King Kong is being made under, is off of this, like, insane documentary that people, you know, some people believed. Much like Birth of a Nation. Like, all of these things, again, are tied together. So also, just to take it back a little bit, I wanted to revisit. So a big thing at, like, the heart of King Kong is you know, giant monstrous ape chases down this white woman. That's his whole thing. It's he's obsessed with this white woman. Within the context of the film, they offer six of their women for one, you know, beautiful white woman, you know, so put it again, like creating this valuation.
Yep.
And it plays into, so Angela Davis wrote in her book, Women, Race, and Class. This is something I wrote, like talking about this. So in chapter 11.
Hold on. No, give yourself the credit. This is Joshua. He's only done this a couple other times before, but he is about to read to cite himself, and rightly so. You know, so
oh, Joe.
I mean, give yourself the flowers, girl.
It's more we're you know,
call me Chevron. I'm gassing you up, girl.
But it's more about Angela Davis. So she talks about the pervasive myth of the black male rapist. So in the vein of many urban legends, you know, this is used to scare people for a variety of sociopolitical goals of the ruling white establishment. So curbing political and economic revolt would be extremely useful function of lynching, for instance. So if you kind of tell people like black men cannot control themselves around white women, you know, it creates all of these, like, you know, social divisions. All, you know, it's a very Davis contextualized lynching as a valuable political weapon and necessitated justification, which was provided by the black rapist myth. So by utilizing violence and perpetuating this myth, white proponents of black equality became increasingly afraid to associate themselves with black people's struggles for liberation. So convincing white people that black men were fundamentally incapable of controlling their violent sexual urges make them a threat, specifically to white women, which is a powerful weapon against intersectionality in the struggle. You know, I've said this before, you know, poor white women, and this is something she supports in this, had more to gain aligning with black men than they did with rich white women, especially at this time, like class, you know, the struggles of class problems. So, but due to like the propaganda of this like myth, you know, kept, you know, the classes struggled. So, or kept, you know, people in the struggle without seeing the ways that their oppression were tied together. So, and we see that this myth still persists today because we see how violence against black bodies is ratified through the lens of threat. So, all that to say, now we move over to horror noir.
I'm actually going to send you something right now.
Okay.
Because it's an old image. It's a cover. You may know what I'm going to send you as I describe it. It's a cover of a Vogue magazine from almost 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And it features LeBron James on it. And I don't know who the model is. Giselle. It's actually Giselle. But it is very racist because he is playing with a basketball. And he is holding, we'll post it also on our social media.
Yeah.
Wow. There's several
articles.
That's
quite an image.
It's quite an image, but basically it shows LeBron James like mouth open, assuming that like he's roaring some triumphant roar, and then like holding Giselle in one hand, in the other arm, and side by side with the poster of King Kong.
Wow.
And
yeah.
Fay Wray being held by, clutched by Kong. So
yeah, that's a very powerful image, and what I'm like citing that Angela Davis is talking about. I mean, this goes back to like the Reformation,
yeah.
Like you know, so these
Reconstruction,
are, yeah, Reconstruction, yeah, yeah, exactly. Sorry, the Reformation.
It's like Martin Luther out here,
right,
in these streets.
Yes, the Reconstruction era. So we're talking about like 18, you know, 60s and 1870, yeah. Like that. This, you know, especially because there were communities of free people who were like creating their own governments and stuff. And this is like the myth of the black male rapist really helped destroy a lot of that and really helped empower and embolden the KKK in ways that, you know, I mean, maybe, who knows, again, we can't really speak to what maybe could or could not have been, but these myths were extremely powerful and they're echoed in films like Ngagi and in King Kong. So, This is, again, Jungle Fever, a horror romance. This is from Horror Noir, where we talk about if Ngagi prompted audiences to consider the repulsive sexual mores of black women, then King Kong extended the assault to metaphorically implicate black men through the imagery of the big black ape in pursuit of a white woman. So this is where she talks about, like, the coded black. And this happens a lot in horror noir and in readings of, like, the other in general, whether it's black people, queer people, you know, the ways that we kind of show up as monsters. And, you know, so even though that character may not be a, you know, a black person, we can read that it stands in for, like, that threat to white supremacy and to white, you know, that's a queer person as a threat to, you know, the straight world. So the code of black, in which blackness is implicitly carried in the form of an ape. Kong is blackened or racially coded when juxtaposed against the presence of whites in the film. Kong is the color black, emerging from, quote, lower primitive culture, which he is surrounded by black natives, or mini Kongs when they dress up like apes to worship their big Kong. You know, the soundtrack that accompanies it, lots of drums, and, you know, these are typical of jungle films and the appearance of black natives. The film continues to confine understandings of blackness to wildness, sexuality to savagery, adding fears of the big black phallus. So in doing so, King Kong piled on another reason for the dark other's termination. His body is far too endowed in comparison to the more modestly appointed white man. That's a nice way of putting that. Kong is chained, shipped to the U.S., his middle passage, where he experiences a bit of slavery before being executed for going on a rampage in pursuit of a white woman. So, yeah. that all, I think, you know, this, like, you know, yeah. I see all of that in King Kong. Again, you know, I thought about in doing King Kong for a long time that we would put it in sort of like a conversation about Beauty and the Beast. So like Creature from the Black Lagoon, King Kong, a literal black, you know, I mean, Beauty and the Beast horror films that have been made. But I mean, I'm glad I separated it out and we can talk more about, you know, just big giant monsters. But I really appreciate like that. Having horror noir kind of cast that, you know,
contextualize it. Yeah.
Yeah. To contextualize. There's also, man, so many other things. I was looking at, well, this is kind of off like subject, but there's like one, line where I can't remember who says it, but he's like, women can't help being a bother. I was like,
yep.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It's the whole, like, when she's on the ship.
Yeah, they're so, yeah. Like, they keep just putting her down.
And then he, like, falls in love with her, right? It's the same guy?
Yeah, I think so. It's, yeah, they have a really...
The call is coming from inside the house, and...
Yeah, they have a really strange relationship in that film. But what was I going to say about... again, dear listener, if you've not seen horror noir, I can't recommend it enough, just because of all of like the great like analysis of sort of what's happening within like horror films, especially something like King Kong. The other thing I was going to say, sorry, I got myself like sidetracked here. So this is from the article that I'm sharing with everyone, The Theory and Appeal of Giant Monsters. And I kind of like this. So, there are other fictions, the all-pervasive fiction of racial identity. There is no biological basis for racial identity whatsoever, which results in systemic oppression of entire populations, nationhood, a fiction with a very young history and a disproportionate amount of bloodshed for its purposes, and so on. What is important for our purposes is realizing that in the context of a human civilization governed by fantasies, it makes perfect sense that the act of deliberately imagining a fantastic scenario contains within it the inherent capacity to shed light on the actual fantasies which govern our lives. So for England in 1897, H.G. Wells imagined that Martians could engage in the same kind of colonial assault on London as the British Empire itself had launched on much of the globe, which is simply to say that we never would have had an alien invasion subgenre without the social practice of colonialism, which we've talked about on the show before, and like zombie narratives and things like that. When you talk about like who gets invaded, who gets colonized, like it's very interesting that, you know, the horrors that we place on other people and the things that we do, we then create, like, well, like with King Kong, you know, we put people in these situations where, you know, we enslave people, we treat them awfully, and then we're like white people, white supremacy was a literal nightmare in the lives of these people, was a horror every day in their lives. And then we have the audacity to put all of our fears into them, you know? And so to create like this giant Kong monster that like represents like black male sexuality and threat and, you know, the perception of threat, you know, and we got to protect our white women from this monster when like, we're the ones who have tortured these people. You know, these people meaning, you know, those we've
non-white
enslaved,
people.
You know, non-white people that we've enslaved, that we've harmed, that we've hurt. And I mean, and that still continues today. You know, we create conditions in countries that create refugees, and then, and it's our fault. Like we bomb stuff, we do things, we, you know,
and then when they come here,
they're the bad people. They're villainized by, you know, certain, ex-presidents, many ex-presidents, you know, so I just see like Kong, I think, is a really good representation because you're talking about a time, this is before the civil rights movement. You know, we have, you know, lots of separation between people, you know, yes, slavery might technically be over, but we're still very much dealing with the effects, barely one generation removed.
Yeah.
I mean, in 1933,
yeah,
you know, we're not that far from it. And so you have all of these horrors, and then again, we're creating this film and putting our, like, that's our fears on display, you know? It's very, it goes back to when I was talking about the perception of threat. This is something Judith Butler talked about with George Yancey, I think is his name, from Duke, maybe.
Okay.
But anyways, they talk about how all lives matter. That's not been historically realized. Like, we can say it all we want, but it's not true.
Yeah.
We can believe it in the abstract, philosophically, but the real truth is that a police officer gets to decide when and how they're afraid, and who is a threat, who is perceived as a threat, based on a system that threatens those very same people on a daily basis and makes their lives, you know, a horror film. Again, we talk about that, like, you know, in a horror movie, people get in the car, they drive somewhere, you know, they stop at a gas station, something terrible happens to them, and then it's a horror film filled with white people, you know, screaming in terror, when that is a very real everyday fear
for queer people,
for trans people, for
black people,
for black people, that you can, an ordinary day, you know, you get pulled over by the wrong cop and then you're done. Your life is over. Yeah. Like, that's the real horror. And so Kong is just one of those things where it's like, yeah, it really encapsulates a very interesting, particular moment in history about the fears of the black body.
I just want to talk through again what you just said about, because it's actually it's kind of blowing my mind, the idea that like white creators, I hesitate to say content creator because that's probably what they would be called now, but these white content creators in the 1930s white artistic culture at the time, when you're thinking about horror as a mirror or horror as a reflection of societal ill, reflection of real life horror, or, you know, real threats.
A container, a vessel.
A vessel of threat. That they're projecting all of that perceived horror, but at the same time, they're creating it. It's all from conditions that they've created. So it's like, you know, is it any wonder that Kong fought back, because you like brought him there and you brought him there to Broadway, to this big theater? You know, that was probably the funniest part of the whole movie, was like everyone walking into the theater just commenting about like, well, this sucks, but we're here. Like, I paid $20. Like, so I can't sit too close. I'm like, well, you know, you got the best seat because it's not really a picture. It's a personal experience. Like, oh, I thought I was going to see something. And I'm like, yeah, you're about to see like, you know, a bunch of people get murdered by a giant ape.
Yeah, and that brings up again, like, that's, but that again is where King Kong, like, twists a little, because we are asked, I think, to sympathize with them a little bit. Like, he's not, or not even a little bit, because, you know.
Yeah, yes. I think that we're asked to sympathize with him, but, like, it's interesting, and thinking about, like, the people who make film, right? These empathetic creatures, people who are artists, who, you know, have, you know, it's the idea that, like, the villain, we are meant to believe that the villain is Kong, but if you watch and pay attention to the film, the villain is, what's the name of the fucker who, Carl, what's his name? Carl something?
Carl Denham.
Yes. Denham's the fucking villain, because he's like, you know, he's the one who forces people to go there. He takes, like, you know, might, like, love this. They're doing the ceremony for the first bride of Kong, and he's like, bring the camera, and he takes his camera out, and he just, like, sets up this, like, giant 1930s film camera, and it's like, oh, well, they see us, and then they come
over. Yeah, they have eyes.
They have eyes. And also, you have, like, you know, half a battalion of soldiers, half the fucking, like, U.S. Navy behind you, and then the audacity of this white man to be, to, like, okay, well, Cap, Skipper, go talk to them. Like, you did this. This is your fucking fault.
Oh, and that whole nonsense of, like, that he, like, speaks, quote, native. Like, what does that even mean? Like, well, they wash above the shore of this, like, island, and he just speaks the language of the people.
I know.
Whole thing was bonkers.
Which I did love that, because I had the subtitles on, because, you know, 1930s audio, and it had, like, it wasn't, like, in parentheses, speaks native. It was, like, the actual script of what they were saying. And it's like, Rapa Nui, Hong Kong, like, Kong, you know, whatever, whatever. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, this skipper would be, you know. And hold on, I have a semi-funny point, so can I make it? Or do you have, okay, so.
Go ahead.
So I'm watching this, and the other thing that, like,
started kind of heavy, so we can
thank you. I was like, let's lighten up a little bit. So, you know, watching, not having watched King Kong, not even having watched the remakes, but having just general things about it, knowing the anti-black racist subtext of it, you know, the all of this stuff, horror noir of it all, right? And seeing the native people on Skull Island, you know, how, like, there's a lot of black people there. I was kind of looking, I'm like, okay, is this, like, skin tone, or is this, like, you know, a minstrelly type, you know, did HMU, you know, burn coal, and, you know.
I have not watched it, but that is the accusation on the Peter Jackson remake, is that they, like, made people darker, like, yeah, made them black, like, painted them.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I've not seen it, but it was a criticism I read while I was looking for other critique of King Kong, that somebody was really taking down the Jackson version.
Well, which, I mean, you know, he is like a white, he's like a white Kiwi, right? So, like, he's, you know, like, hey, if you want to know all about, like, the racist history of a New Zealanders, like, you know, wait for Dr. Talley's fucking research is going to come out later.
Right.
But, so, you know, we can talk about that and the colonialism, all of that. But, like, you seeing all of this, right? And, like, in my mind, I'm thinking, like, okay, like, he's, like, this giant ape that's supposed to be the stand-in for, like, black male, malicious black male predatory desire, right?
Right.
Tell me why, though, what got me, you know, in the words what the kids say, what got me fucked up, though, is the fact that I'm, like, Kong is fucking Asian. Like, this is, like, in Indonesia somewhere. Like, this is, like, these are, like, my people. Like, you know, this is, like, I'm, like, Kong is, like, because I look, I that's why I've been on my phone, like, where the fuck is Skull Island? And Skull Island is, like, is supposed to be in, like, in Asia, like, Indonesia somewhere. And I'm, like, what? Like, Kong do be Asian, though. So,
yeah,
I mean,
well,
like,
you know, racists aren't great at geography, or like, it doesn't really matter. Yeah.
Racists aren't great at geography. But, like, for me, I just keep thinking, like, damn, is this also something to be said about, like, you know, is there some I mean, racism is racism, right? And, yeah, like, you know, the it's the, because it's like, because of all of the darkness, like it's immediately calling in like the anti-black racism of it all. But in my mind, I'm like, damn, fucking Kong's fucking Asian. Like,
yeah. So that's very fascinating. Cause you're kind of seeing it in a whole other like context, you know, because again, I'm pulling from like black scholarly work who, you know, are identifying, you know, a very, I think a very valid and very real, yes, like, yes, you know, racism, but that is adds a whole other level of like, just when you thought racism couldn't get any more racismer.
Yeah. Well, it's also, I mean, like, you know, again, like I identify primarily as Pacific Islander, right?
Right.
But so, you know, Guam was colonized by Spain for so long. It is not unrealistic in like the 300 years that like Spain colonized Guam and used it as a port while passing through the Pacific. It is not unreasonable to expect that like, there could have also been, you know, human cargo on those ships as well.
Right.
And so, and that's the other thing too, when you think about like, when you think about how anti-black racism and colorism comes from like anti-black racism, and how in like Asian and Pacific Islander cultures, it like dark skin is not a good thing. Like there's whitening creams, right, all of those things. There's all of this intense colorism that's there. And so it's like, it totally even if like King Kong is Asian, it still tracks and supports and, you know, further supports and, you know, what's the, my favorite term to use in an essay, buttresses the
buttresses.
It buttresses.
That. Is it providing like the scaffolding, the foundation?
Yes. The foundation, the buttress. It's buttressing the work of these black scholars talking about Kong as a representation of this black racism. So these are also like, I'm literally thinking all these things as I'm like sort of watching the first all the way up to Skull Island. Cause I'm just like, I'm not engaging with the film in as a, like losing myself in the world. And that's the, talking out loud with you, that's the other reason why it's difficult for me to get into like old movies, is because I can't get lost in the world, because it's just so different. Like, you know, I like a modern film because it's easier for me to imagine getting lost in the world than it is. I just wanted to just, you know, defend myself a little bit for the folks out there.
I can respect that.
Not you, but like out there who, you know, Joe doesn't like anything old. And I'm like, well, you know.
Well, no, I mean, I can respect that. Yeah, I mean, there is definitely, it's easier to lose ourselves in worlds that look more like the one we inhabit or are, you know, in color, I guess. But yeah, again, I think it just, you know, kind of brought it back to like, again, these like white motherfuckers are causing these problems and then like pearl clutching at the consequences, you know, like, oh, look, if it isn't the consequences of my actions coming to bite me in the ass, you know, because I was thinking about that, too, in that when I was talking earlier about Angela Davis, she also talks a lot about how, you know, white men were like constantly like, you know, telling, you know, women like, they're going to be raped, you know, you're going to be raped by black men. But you know who was doing a lot of the raping?
The white men.
Do you know who's raping a lot of black women?
The white men.
You know, so it's like, again, you know, like sort of what you're talking about, like they pull Kong out of like his habitat where he was, again, I mean, I don't want to say he was fine just because, you know, there is a group of people who are worshiping him in some capacity and feeding him, you know, women. So, I, you know, it's like there's already stuff kind of happening in that.
I mean, to him, he was fine.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
He's in his natural habitat, you know, wrestling with the Tyrannosaurus, wrestling with a Stegosaurus, wrestling with an Elasmosaurus. Yeah, the Pterodon. Oh, by the way, dear listeners, make sure you check our Instagram because I watched this movie with my little buddy Hemlock, who I think he has an easier time. They must have an easier time seeing black and white films. He was enthralled with King Kong. I mean, he just sat and watched like most of it with me. It was so hilarious, like just watching his little head like bob back and forth, especially with the, I mean, I get it, it's like birds on screen and stuff, I know why he was watching it, but it was super funny, so I took some videos and I'm gonna post them, so make sure you check that out because it was so cute.
Also, the first real kill, like the first real kill we see is a fucking, what looks to me like a brontosaurus eating a man, and I was like, girl, no, can't, I'm out, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, well, again, we're talking about 1930,
yes, and then the, you know, and that's the other thing too, like the prevailing, like, the prevailing theory at the time of the dinosaurs at that time would have been that they died out from a massive famine. Like we don't get the meteor hit everyone and, you know, wiped out the world until like what, the 70s or 80s, something like that. So I just had to remind myself that I'm like, it's great that we're getting like such cool representation of dinosaurs from the 30s that like still hold up a lot. Like I just watched Jurassic World Dominion and it's still pretty faithful.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. And I also was thinking about it this time, like, the Loch Ness Monster had kind of reinvigorated people's imaginations. I think the surgeon's photograph is like a year from King Kong, but there was like reports of it. So we were living in a really interesting time about thinking about dinosaurs and giant lizards. Was the Komodo dragon even discovered yet? I can't remember.
Ooh,
what year, but,
that's a good, hold on. Know. Keep vamping. I'll find out.
Yeah, but anyways, I guess, what I was trying to say earlier is like, obviously this movie has some negative things to say about women and their value. So I don't want to be like, oh, everything was perfect on Skull Island with Kong. I mean, he's being fed these like virgin women and, I do have a problem with that. again, religions and stuff like that can be very damaging to women.
No.
But, they pull him out. They take him to New York. They chain him up. It's like, he's a giant ape out of his element. Like, of course he's going to like, break free and terrorize New York. The Cooper and I don't know how you say his name. Chodesack, I guess, is what I'm going to go with.
I think it's Chodesack, right? Like,
okay. They denied any, of course, any hidden meaning. Mm-hmm. That it was just no allegories to it. But I guess Cooper was quoted later as saying that he had kind of imagined. He saw like an airplane or something in the sky and imagined like what it would be like if there was like a giant gorilla on top of the tallest building in the world and he was being shot down by modern weapons, armed airplanes, and that it could be this story of the primitive doomed by modern civilization, which I do also see in this.
Yes.
As especially in this time in the world, like the world is a hell of a lot smaller than it was in the 30s.
Absolutely.
And in the 1830s and the 1730s, and go back and back and back. So I think it's very, I do think there's a really good, just removing like the conversations around race and what we know are the genesis for Kong, taking that out. I do really see, this conversation about like how, as we've grown, as civilizations have grown, we're wiping out. I mean, we know languages are lost. Species are lost, as the world becomes more and more, global conglomerate of,
tame
space
rocks. I mean, not even global conglomerate, like quote tame, right? Like as becomes more known to us, becomes more tame.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's very few places that like remain pristine and untouched by the modern world.
Yeah.
And this film is also like, it's that awful manifest destiny, like, must be conquered type of thing that like is a very Western idea. And, because these people, like if we had just left them there and let them do their own thing, like, obviously it's not great, but like, they could have just, done that, let them be them.
Yeah, that was their world that they're in. It's just like when like missionaries, like these people didn't know about God, so we had to go and tell them. It's like, no, you didn't. Mm-mm. You didn't need to do that. Yeah. So I appreciate that sort of narrative. Again, I don't, I don't think it's the primary. Like I do feel like these guys in the 30s probably had some racist ideas, and I do think they feed into the film. And the writers, even Rose, again, like not to, it's just, people are products of their time.
Products
I don't really
time.
Know. I never met these people. I never heard them but it speaks.
We don't have recordings. We don't have the receipts.
Yeah. And again, I do like the end, cause there is something really kind of cool about this audience watching Kong. It echoes like this film. Cause you have the film within a film that they're trying to make. Then you have Kong on display. And so it's kind of like, I also feel he represents in that moment, like the horror film itself, like breaking free into the audience, and we take it home with us. You know, we leave the film with the fears it's given us, with the images it's given us, you know, and they invade our nightmares, or they, you know, or makes us nervous, you know, to get into a shower by ourselves or to turn on a fuzzy TV, you know. Like I also feel like there can be something said about, you know,
the surveillance, the police, the body policing of it all.
Yeah, and just the not even just that, but just the spectacle of horror itself. You know, of terror, and we try to tame it through the horror film. And you have in this moment, you know, they're trying to tame this thing for entertainment purposes, and then, you know, of course it gets out and it unleashes itself, and we take horror in that same way. We leave it, we give it to others, we share it, you know, we think about what makes us afraid.
We try to control it, but then in this case it ends up being uncontrollable until we, you know, deal with it.
Yeah. So I also kind of appreciate you know, just the spectacle of it all, again, to take it back to our conversation about Nope. Yeah. You know, I feel like there was one more thing I was going to bring up, but it has left me.
It done leave you.
It's all right. We've definitely, you know, we've talked about plenty.
Yeah.
You know, something I was also thinking about is, you know, these jungle films, like primates were rare on a display. So that's another thing that these sort of films is people didn't really see, like, monkeys and apes in like zoos and stuff yet. It was still kind of a rare thing. So I think that's why Ngagi was sort of powerful, is because the images that, like, people could really believe that, like, you know, you look at an ape. I mean, imagine seeing an ape. If you grew up in fucking Iowa in 1900 and then somebody shows you a gorilla, you know, and you've never seen one, never seen a drawing of it, like, you might think it's a person, like some kind of humanoid creature.
Yeah.
So I think that's
the propensity for human beings, right, to read faces and to anthropomorphize things, like at what, Uncanny Valley?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, that sort of realm. So it's like, yeah, I imagine that this was very, you know, like a powerful film in a lot of ways, just like Ngagi was, because of, like, just the general, ignorance of, like, people. We just didn't know the world.
Yeah.
So seeing something like this, it's just, it had to be such a fantastic experience. And to think that maybe there is an island out there. This also feeds into that kind of conversation we've had about other particular science fiction films, about science and what remains to be discovered. Like, these sorts of films give us hope that there are still things we don't know. So to take something positive out of Kong, you know, you know, the racism of it all. If we think also about, like, what remains in the world to be discovered, what will we find? What will science find? Yeah. What will we stumble upon? What's at the bottom of the ocean? What's out in space? There is something also to take out of here. You know, they call them the eighth wonder of the world in there. And I think these sorts of films also kind of encapsulate and represent, you know, the hope that we might have that there's so much more to know.
Yeah.
You know, especially 1933, you'd be like, what? Maybe there is a pterodactyl on some island somewhere, or there's a fucking plesiosaur swimming around a fucking lake in Scotland, you know?
So like, what if you saw, like, you know, like an ape for the first time? Like, would you be like, oh my God, that's no ape, that's my cousin. Like, is that what you would say? I don't know. I'm looking at you mainly because you're from, you know, you're from Iowa, Ohio. I don't know.
I would imagine it was one of my siblings' cousins.
Yes.
They have some simian-looking motherfuckers over in there. I will say, there's some, you know.
Ooh, dog, shade of it all.
There's some real monkey-looking motherfuckers. But, you know, that's a whole other thing, you know. Just a step down in the evolutionary ladder. but that's a whole other conversation. These are all white people, by the way.
Yes, they're
white,
all
white trash is the soup du jour. All righty, well,
the soup du jour.
I I mean, I'm sad that you didn't enjoy it more. Like, just out of the simple, like, you know, I don't want you to waste your time watching films you don't like. But, I mean, the importance of this film is really
Joshua,
powerful.
Why start now?
Well, that's true.
We've been doing this for a long time. Why start now? But
that's true.
But to be completely honest, what saved the entire experience was this conversation.
Excellent. Well, that's what we aim to do. Yeah. So, thank you, thank you, thank you for listening. I'm glad that we could have this conversation. And we'll be back at you, folks, next week. Good night.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davy Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
Ha 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 ha!